Andrew Talks to Chefs is an independent podcast. For current and past episodes, Andrew's blog, contact information, and more, please visit andrewtalkstochefs.com. To support us, please visit patreon.com/andrewtalkstochefs. Enjoy the show.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Hoonie Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
What's the most shine on its own thing you will do other than an oyster?
Like, and put on a plate at a restaurant?
Yeah.
I think the first thing that came to my mind was just asparagus sautéed in good butter with sea salt.
Yeah, anything else would be a unwanted distraction.
Yeah.
Did it take you a long time to get to that place, or did growing up on a farm pre-wire you for openness? Like, that to me is egoless cooking. But did it take you time to come to that, or do you feel like that you...
Oh, yeah.
You, it did.
Absolutely. And I think that's every cook's problem almost, is like, you want to just add more.
That is James Wayman of Oyster Club and other restaurants in Mystic, Connecticut, our guest on today's episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. Our guest today is James Wayman. James is somebody I've known about actually for a few years, although I didn't meet him until recently. Friends of mine like Jeff Gordonier, who you all know from the pod, and Jimmy Bradley, my old podcasting partner, have visited his Oyster Club restaurant and loved it and told me all about it. And the restaurant community that he is a part of has been steadily growing in the last few years, adding Grass and Bone and the Engine Room, which are places that we describe in detail in the interview. So I finally trekked up to Mystic a few weeks ago and did something I hadn't done in half a year. I spent a day in the field on assignment. James gave me a tour of Stoneacre Farms, where he's been doing Oyster Club pop-ups this summer. Then we visited Grass and Bone, where we had lunch, including, I have to say, the best Reuben sandwich I have ever had in my life, and that is not an exaggeration. Actually, it's an understatement. The gap between that sandwich and the next closest Reuben I ever had is pretty enormous. And then my wife Caitlin and I returned a few weeks later for their second-to-last summer night's pop-up dinner. And as you'll hear in this interview, James is a thoughtful, gentle, I would say, soul. And it wasn't at all surprising to me that that was reflected in his dinner at the farm. The dishes were fashioned from local fish and produce. They were straightforward, but deeply satisfying and complex on the palate. And the entire evening was just wonderful. And I'm really glad I made the return trip to experience it. You'll hear a little wind and crowd noise in the background because of where we were for this interview. You can also have a look at the photo for this episode to get a better sense of that location, but I think it adds tremendous and very appropriate atmosphere to the conversation, so I didn't do very much to mix it out of the sound when I put this show together. The interview is a bit all over the place in what I think is the absolute best way. It's a real spontaneous give and take between two people getting to know each other, and I don't think I need to say another word about it. So let's get right to my conversation with Chef James Wayman. Here you go. Where exactly are we? I don't mean the town. I mean, what is this place where we are?
So we're at the point of the Stonington Borough, overlooking Long Island Sound. From here, you can see Rhode Island, Connecticut, and New York, Fisher's Island over there. So got all three sides, some birds circling around it over some fish. Hope to hit the water later and catch some.
That's like a big thing for you?
Yeah, I love the fish.
Yeah. What is it with chefs and fishing? I know so many chefs who love to fish.
It is. I agree. I mean, there is a thing. I think it's seeing the whole process through.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, I think we're naturally curious. So kind of from, you know, if you're into farming, it's, you know, seeing how a seed goes from, you know, a seed to a plant to the end product on the plate. And if you're on the water, it's catching the fish, cleaning the fish,
right?
knowing how fresh it is, being part of the entire process. I think that's the fascinating
part. Interesting. See, I always thought maybe, and other people have said to me that it, because it's such a temperamental is the wrong word, but I guess ambient, different. It's like a polar opposite to being in a kitchen. You know, it's slower, it's quiet. You can't control the pace if you wanted to. The fish control the pace. So you have to give over to that. Does that resonate with you at all?
It does. I think of it personally that way, but I could see that. I mean, it's definitely an escape. I think this may be a little esoteric, but I think chefs are kind of watery people.
What does that mean? I love that, but I don't know what it means.
It actually comes from Chinese medicine. So somebody that's a water constitution is somebody that's very connected with water, but also, some of the kind of connections with that are water constitutions naturally overwork. They have a hard time of finding balance.
Huh.
Their kind of story is I'm not powerful enough, so there's a lot of ego involved. So I think you find a lot of people in creative fields and chefs are driven that way, are water constitutions, so the connection to water.
This is a rebuke to Bruce Lee, right? To be like water. This is kind of a rebuke to that whole notion.
I guess. I mean, there's positives and negatives, right? I mean,
right.
I don't say that necessarily in a negative way.
Right.
I think that's part of the reason chefs are so amazing too, is that kind of like intensity and creative drive and connection. And water has a lot of, there's a lot of metaphors around water for sure.
Right. So listen, we're sitting here, it's mid-August. We're very lucky, we're in states that are doing relatively well with COVID. We've spent a good portion of the day that we just spent touring around talking about this kind of thing. I very selfishly want to try not to talk about it at all, or at least hold it till the end.
That's quite all right.
Because, and I don't know what it's like for you. I don't know what your disposition is generally to doing interviews, but this is my, I told you, this is my first time since early March sitting in person with microphones and a recorder. And I am so happy, right? I've been happy all day hanging out with you and getting a tour.
Great.
But this is doing my spirit a world of good, and I kind of want to roll with that and do, I want to do a normal biographical interview.
Amazing.
Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Would that
fine.
Be as refreshing for you as it is for me? You don't have to lie to me.
No, absolutely would.
It would be.
Yeah, and I can't think of a better place. I mean, it's absolutely
great.
Stunning here and calming. That water is calming, so maybe that's why chefs like it.
Perhaps. Well, now I have to go do some reading about water constitutions. Okay, so James, why don't you tell me, well, first of all, let's go in a little bit in reverse order. You were just driving me around town.
Mm-hmm.
You showed me the first restaurant here where you were the chef.
I did.
It is a very charming, it's exactly what you would expect Mystic, Connecticut to be. You're even when you're not seeing the water, you're aware that you're in a coastal community. It feels like that. The storefronts have, the look of a New England-y coastal community. What I would like to know is, we are here in what is the time that these areas really thrive, right? This is like the high season normally for these places. What's winter like here? We were going down that street just now coming here after lunch where you showed me the that restaurant, and I was like, I was trying to imagine that street like on a snowy day, and it's probably like a whole nother town in the winter.
It is different. Absolutely very different, and in a lot of ways, and also different from when I started here 20 years ago in this town. So back then winters would be incredibly quiet. But you would, when you asked about a snowy day, I mean, those have been some of the funnest days I can remember in restaurants, because it's towns like these, like Mystic, like Stonington, everybody's pretty close together. So those were often days where people would, to get out of the house, put on a heavy winter coat and walk down to the restaurant to get some cheer, to get some drinks, to get some hot food. So there is kind of a feeling around that of those winter days, and they would be very quiet. I mean, I remember when our restaurant Oyster Club first opened in the winter, you know, there'd be days where, you know, you'd have 15 or 20 guests. But now, I think as we've grown, this town and this area has become more populous and more known for food.
Yeah.
That it's more of a year round, but definitely summer is the time when it gets very intense around here for sure.
Well, it's been fun just knocking around with you today because everywhere we've gone, I mean, one of these places was your restaurant. The other one was the farm. But, you know, even at the restaurant, not necessarily people who work there. You know, there are these characters coming in. I don't mean characters in a bad way, but these people coming and going and you saying hello to people. There is very much this small town vibe that is just... It's great. I mean, it's great. I mean, it feels like you really found your place here.
Absolutely. You know, to me, that makes me think about one of the words we talk about a lot in our company, and we're actually called the 85th Day Food Community is kind of the broader term for our restaurant group. It is community. And it's an important motivation for us to grow that community,
yeah.
To support the people around us, to get to know the people around us, whether they're customers, whether they're the people that are growing or catching our food or food artisans that may be making cheese or brewing beer. Is that connection, and to me, really one of my favorite parts of what we do here.
Take me back, as I haven't said to anyone in a while, take me back to... to your childhood, to your first kind of memories of whatever you would term it, food, cooking, restaurants, the thing that was kind of the spark when maybe you didn't know it at the time, but the spark that kind of started you down this road.
Sure. I mean, the first place I go is to my grandparents' farm where I spent a good chunk of my childhood years. So just being around fresh food, I mean, I think that resonates with me to this day. It was a pick your own berry farm.
Oh, you mean they had like signs on the roadside and people would come and at the end you'd like weigh it and pay for.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was called Arrow Farm, which my grandparents were Arthur and Rose. So it was kind of a connection of their,
oh, cool.
their two names.
Yeah.
He was a doctor. So it was kind of, it was a gentleman farm. But I remember, and I still feel this to this day, the kind of excitement when, like, the strawberries would get ripe. And you'd find, you know, I figured out along the way that, like, the biggest blueberries were, like, back underneath everything. So you could find those. And, you know, also back to the strawberries, like a hot strawberry in the field. Like, there's these kind of food memories that... like I feel like still kind of continue with me to this day. So I think that was the start of it. Both my mom and my grandmother, I lived on the farm with my mother at the time, and then my grandmother and grandfather lived just across the field in another house.
Got it. Now, can I ask, were your parents divorced or?
Yes.
Okay.
My mom was divorced, she was a single mom, and then my stepdad, who's still married to my mom, call my dad now, Jeff, came along when I was about 9.
Uh-huh.
But there was a period of time in between there where we were living on the farm solo.
Got it.
But I would spend a lot of time with my grandparents and my parents. And although the cooking wasn't complicated, I feel there was a lot of use of fresh ingredients and vegetables and food from the farm.
Was there a lot of recipe-based cooking, or was it more sort of intuitive, just stuff that was familiar enough that they could whip it up without breaking out an index card or a book or something?
Some of both, I think. I think some of the successes were more recipe-based.
Okay.
Maybe... there weren't a ton of failures that I can remember. I remember my mom's first attempt at making like the rice vermicelli.
Yeah.
And I remember being very young, and I called them brain noodles because they had this like soft, squishy kind of texture to them. But, you know, the dinner table was always important. I remember especially my grandparents when family would come around from out of town. My mom had 3 brothers. So we'd all get together during holidays,
yeah,
and you know, my cousins as well, and you know, it would definitely be about you know, food was the kind of central thing, whether it was fancy or not. You know, there was hors d'oeuvres, mm-hmm. and, you know, and snacks. I remember especially loving the canned black olives, which I think is rather strange for a young boy.
Uh-huh.
And smoked oysters.
Huh.
Pickled herring and cream was one of my favorite things. Also kind of strange for...
I think you were destined to be a chef. These are all...
And I actually haven't thought about that before, but those are kind of real foods.
What do you mean real foods?
They're whole foods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like, I feel they're not, it's not like it was a bag of chips.
Right. You know? Well, they're also foods that would reward, like you and I have talked today, and several times you've mentioned reading about something or looking into something, right? You're a very curious person.
Absolutely.
And a lot, maybe not the black olive so much, but the other things you just named, those are things that would reward curiosity, right? Like if you went and did some reading, you might find out some interesting things about different cultures and why those things came into being and what the palate, generally speaking, of certain countries were. Yeah?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a traditional bias and connection to something, a place.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Did you perceive any of that back then or no? You just liked it?
No, I don't think so. I just liked it.
Yeah.
It was more of a sensory connection.
Yeah.
It's like it tasted good.
Yeah. Right.
It tasted good.
And where you grew up, the farm setting, was it an agricultural area? Was that unusual amongst your friends that you were living in that kind of a place?
I think so. North Carolina is definitely an agricultural area.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't recall growing up having other friends whose parents lived on farms.
Uh-huh.
There were other small farms around us, but I think it was a little unusual.
Like your schoolmates weren't living in a similar situation.
No.
Was there a novelty factor to that? Like I would imagine going to visit a kid you've got to smile as I'm asking this. I would imagine as a kid not growing up on a farm, if I had a friend who like lived on a farm, that I would find that, I don't know. I would see potential for adventure.
There was.
Or good, you know, good game playing.
For sure. No, I mean, the woods was great. I'm smiling, I think, because I've always been kind of introverted, so I didn't have a huge amount of friends. And maybe that growing up, I mean, I would play by myself out in the woods all the time.
Interesting. What would you play?
Probably just imaginations, you know, like I don't even remember a scenario, but things that I would do is, that's where I got my love of fishing, for instance. There was a pond, so I would go fish. There was two ponds, actually.
Yeah.
I would fish. There was, in that area, a very old history of Native Americans. So I would spend a lot of time walking through fields. Actually, one of my mom's friends used to nickname me Young Arrowhead because I'd spend a lot of time doing that.
Okay.
And these are, I mean, I've always enjoyed, I've had this connection with nature.
Yes.
Which I think informs the way I cook.
Yeah.
And I've enjoyed being by myself. I've enjoyed quiet, introspective things. And I think I just really thrived.
Yeah. That's so interesting. I mean, what's interesting to me, just to jump way out of context, is, you know, we and tell me if you don't want me to talk about this, you know, on mic, but we talked over lunch that you're a practicing Buddhist,
mm-hmm.
That you've done some extended meditations. One of them was a 10-day one in Thailand?
Thailand, in Chiang Mai, yes.
But it's you know, I mean, you just told me that over lunch, casually, maybe an hour ago, and then you tell me just now, as even as a kid, you were very comfortable being on your own, that you were kind of independent, you know, you didn't mind solitude. This seems, I mean, having only spent a few hours with you today, this seems like a kind of a defining trait of yours. Is that accurate?
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've always, when you started talking about the water and fishing, to me, there's this, you know, one of the qualities of water is, you know, tranquility and depth, and wisdom, kind of having that metaphor of depth and wisdom.
Yeah.
So I feel like I connect to it on that level, that just kind of, that's why I love to fish, is there is a calmness there. But I feel like I find that in the kitchen, too. I mean, I'm not a yeller. I'm, uh, I generally, you know, just quiet. And some people think I'm intense.
Are you?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
when you say some people think, that usually means they're wrong.
No. I may want to think they're wrong. It's funny. I found out about, 10 or 15 years ago, somebody said, "You're really scary." And I'm like, "What are you talking about? I'm the nicest, quietest guy." And,
right.
But I think that's my, like, when I get quiet, I get intense and focused.
Right. Well, you also don't give, I would think, to people working with you, for you, that you, they're used to people who are more outwardly expressive, right, in that setting. So the absence of that can be perceived, it's like a, you know what I mean? You become like a cipher. You become like a mystery. And that might be concerning to some people.
Sure, especially when they don't see my goofy side. Because I do have, we have a lot of fun in our kitchens, too.
Or maybe sometimes they know they did, you know, not even messed up, did something not 100% right, you know, and they're just waiting for the shoe to drop, and either you noticed and you let it go, or you didn't notice and it wasn't that big a deal. But
I always say
suspense.
Something.
You always say something.
Yeah.
Okay. Talk to me about your first kitchen job and how that led to you deciding to go to cooking school and deciding to make a profession of this.
Sure. So my first kitchen job was actually at this place called Crocodile's Cafe.
Okay.
It was in downtown Greensboro. I was 14 years old. My parents said, "You got to go get a job if you want to buy yourself some clothes and go to the movies and that kind of stuff.
Have a car in a few years."
Yeah. Which I really appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
To this day. I mean, I feel like not enough parents, you know, create that environment where kids need to learn what hard work is. I think there's something very, very wonderful about that, and I'm thankful for it. So the owner was this guy, Richard Rogers. It was simple food. You know, it was pastas and, you know, just a steak and some vegetable dishes. And, you know, this would have been, 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Just on a little street by UNCG Greensboro, and I just loved it right away. There was this like camaraderie. I was a terrible dishwasher at the time, but I think it's important that I did it.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a realness, there was young people, there was energy. I remember we used to throw knives at cardboard boxes after work in the back. He was giving me beer at a very young age.
This is like a traditional old school kitchen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just a lot of fun. And,
right.
And I think, you know, at that point, I didn't realize that it was going to be my life.
Right.
But something about it, like, I really connected to.
That's cool. And then, so at what age do you decide you're going to go to cooking school?
I want to say 22.
Oh, okay.
So there was some time in there between there.
Yeah.
There was. I will also mention that while I was at Crocodile's, I did cook lunch for Miles Davis, which is to this day been kind of maybe my favorite person I've cooked forever.
Yeah, that's cool.
But, yeah, so I spent some time.
Whoa, you can't just let that go. What happened? He just showed up? Was he a regular?
No, he just showed up. He was in town.
He was performing, had a gig?
Yeah, at UNC Greensboro.
He showed up for lunch,
yeah,
dinner?
Yeah, came to lunch.
Came to lunch?
Yeah.
Wow. Did he have a reservation? Were there reservations?
I don't think there were reservations.
So it's just Miles Davis was there?
The owner knew.
That he was coming?
The owner knew that he was coming.
Okay. Wow. Do you remember what he ate?
I don't. I wish I did.
Yeah.
I wish I did. I could make something up, but I won't.
That's pretty cool. I appreciate that. Okay. So in between what? You go to regular college?
Couple. Yeah, so so it definitely was, along with getting a job.
Yeah,
is importance in the kind of continuation of growing into an adult. Going to college was also important in my family.
Mm-hmm.
I went to UNC Asheville. I decided I wanted to go into environmental science. I'm not sure why. I think it was probably my connection to loving nature.
But you didn't have an end game in mind. Like you didn't want to go in, you didn't want to major in that with an eye toward doing X when you got out.
No.
You just found that you found it interesting enough to learn about it.
Yeah, it was okay. It was one of those things, like, you know, people get told they need to go to college and they go to college and they don't really understand why. Well, I quickly learned that I wasn't very good at chemistry. Science and that kind of like very, I guess, organized way of thinking was not me. So I stayed there a year. And then I left and I came back and to my hometown of Greensboro, where my mom was an art professor at a small liberal arts Quaker college called Guilford College. First year I got there, I decided I wanted to be an English major. I've always been drawn to books ever since I was very young. I love the written word. Always loved writing. And
did you ever write fiction?
A little bit. Never stayed with it enough.
But when you say you loved writing, was that the kind of writing you loved, or just any writing? Like you liked writing, you liked writing a term paper?
I liked writing a term paper. I got into writing poetry for a little while. I just, something about it just, I think it's the creativeness of it. And the way I've always been, like I said, very imaginative. Like my favorite, probably, if I would say what my favorite books are, it's The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien. I started reading those when I was 9.
Okay.
And probably read them 25, 30 times.
For real?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It's just it's a comfort. You know, it's something, I love that world that he's created. I did very well for that first year. And then I discovered all the things that maybe a college age young person might discover. Namely, partying, not going to class, not doing the work, hanging out with friends, and then unfortunately failing out of my own mother's college.
Oh, wow.
Sorry, Mom.
In its own way, though, that's an accomplishment.
It is. It is. It's pretty special, and I'm sure she would agree.
I mean, you got to really work for that.
I did. I worked very hard to do that. Well, it helped that her and my dad were in Japan for a semester abroad, so they weren't there.
Got it.
So she got that knowledge when she got back.
Okay.
Yeah. Extra little kick in the pants there. So, but during this all that time, I'd been kind of cooking, you know.
In restaurants or at home?
In restaurants. And at home, some, but in restaurants. And it always felt right to me. And I just remembered I'd gotten to this point at one of my jobs. It was this place, Hams. It was a short order deli kind of place. And I'd started opening up other restaurants for them. And I think they'd even offered me a company car. And I was like, wow, I could take this company.
In the restaurant business?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I could take this company car and this pretty meager salary and, you know, go forth. Or I could dig deeper. And something at that point in me realized that I wanted to learn more about food and cooking. And my grandmother very generously at the time offered to pay for my culinary education.
That's huge.
Huge. Absolutely.
Had she not done that, do you think you still would have gone to cooking school?
I really don't know.
You would have had to take on debt to do it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is again, I mean, if we had this, we've kind of already done an interview today. I'm trying not to repeat it, not that anyone else heard it, but I feel like it's dishonest at some level. But you told, we were talking before, and we said, like, you know, unlike medical school where you go into debt, it's not like for most people who cook, there's a pot of gold at the end of that rainbow. It's not going to pay off, you know, many times over what you invested. You're going to just be in debt for years.
Yeah, I think I was making $7 an hour when I came out of culinary school.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little better now, but...
Yeah. So you went to Johnson & Wales, which is... How far is that even from where we're sitting right now?
45 minutes.
Yeah,
not far.
Close by.
Yeah, I haven't moved much since then.
Did you take to this region when you got up here?
I did. Not as much Providence, but here in the Mystic area specifically. I got done with culinary school. And I went and worked at this really bad job outside of Boston in this little nameless Irish pub. It was pretty wild. There were some unsettling things happening there, I think. And broke up with a girl.
You mean like what we would politely call side businesses?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Did these involve substance or people?
Substance.
Okay.
I think substance and gambling.
Okay.
Okay. Was some of the
Got
stuff
it.
That was going on.
Okay.
It was unsavory. It was in Lynn, Massachusetts, which is an interesting place to be. No offense, Lynn. You're beautiful.
Yeah.
And I was seeing a girl at the time, and we broke up, and I needed somewhere to go. And I had been coming down to the Stonington Borough, this little town we're sitting in right now, for a while to visit some friends. I actually had a cousin that introduced me to the area, actually for the reason of playing music with them, which was one of my other side hobbies, was hand percussion and bass guitar.
Oh, cool. Hand percussion meaning like tambourine?
Congas.
Congas.
So this guy, Mitch Ramos, who was an awesome guy from Puerto Rico that lived in my dorm at Johnson & Wales, had his master's in hand percussion. Yeah, coming down to visit this guy in town here, and when my world got free, I moved here. So I moved to Stonington.
Yeah.
And I've been here ever since.
Wow.
Or at least near.
Yeah. All right. Well, you seem so, of the community here. You seem very at home here.
I am. It feels like home to me.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So how did you hook up with, your business partners here and this little growing collection of ever since I read Tejal Rao's piece, I don't want to say empire anymore.
We call it a community.
You call it a community of restaurants. Okay.
Yes.
How did this start? I mean, you guys have a good thing going here, it seems. Like, even at this precarious time, it seems like you got, there's a pulse to what you guys are doing here. But how did it start? How did you guys find each other, and what was the first venture?
I would agree with you that there is this great energy here. About this place and this area, and I feel like it's growing as well, which is super exciting. So I met Dan Meiser right around nine and a half years ago.
Okay. Also a cook, we should say.
Yes, also with Roots in the Kitchen, working for Danielle Balud.
Mm-hmm.
But with most of his experience, and especially now in the front of the house. But I feel like that's one of our... Because he has that perspective, I feel like we can speak the same language. And one of the things that is super important to me, and I think super powerful to why we've had such success in our community, is the way that we can relate to each other. It's not always good, but we can always be upfront and honest. We're not always going to agree, but we can always have that conversation to get to the agreement, which is really cool. So we actually got introduced by a friend of mine, Tyler Anderson, who's also a chef in Connecticut. And he was actually going to be the chef of Oyster Club, which was Dan and I's first joint venture together. But Tyler decided to go open his own restaurant at the time, Millwright's, and he introduced me to Dan. And I think the first time we really hung out was at my apartment. I was living on a farm. This one was a farm that raised animals.
Okay.
So pigs, goats, ducks, geese, chickens.
Why were you working there? Were you renting a room there?
I was renting a room there.
You were renting a room.
I had known the woman, Donna Sensky. It's called Soto Farm. As a purveyor when I was the chef at the River Tavern in Chester, Connecticut.
Okay.
Once again, a little sordid story. I was in the process of getting a divorce, and I needed somewhere to live. She had a little in-law apartment above her house that I moved into for a couple years.
Okay.
But it was very cool to be connected to that farm. And I still am. We still use her to this day at all of our restaurants and at our butcher shop.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think Dan and I's first date was he came over and we went and did one of my other passions, which is mushroom foraging.
Uh-huh.
So
another solitary thing.
It is. Yeah. And it's another one of the joys of that, and I think it's connects to fishing too, is the, there's a real, like, the surprise. It's like a treasure hunt almost. There's this excitement that happens when a fish bends your rod over.
When you get the tug on the line.
Or when you're walking through the woods and you see this big orange splotch in the distance and it's a big chicken of the woods. Or all of a sudden you spot these little black things all over the forest floor and carpet of black trumpets.
Yeah.
And it's very tactile. You know, there's aroma involved with mushrooms, mm-hmm. with fish too.
Mm-hmm.
I think of it as a pleasant aroma with fish. You know,
yeah.
You know, people have that word fishy, but
yes.
It's more like sea and cucumber.
Oceanic.
Oceanic.
Yeah. Did you ever read the Greg Kunz book, Elements of Taste?
Absolutely.
Where he breaks down, a lot of people I know hate that book. I think that's one of the most brilliant. Peter Kaminsky was his collaborator. Sorry to interrupt, by the way.
No, not at all.
But you know where I'm going. It's one of the best distillations of one chef's point of view into a cookbook. And what they do is they break it down, I think, into 14 different types of flavors. And one of them is, they call platform flavors, I think. And it's like the base of a dish, right? So it's like meat. And then they don't say fish, they say oceanic.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's like flavors that push, right? And flavors mm-hmm. that pull. I mean, it's completely unique to Greg Kunz. I mean, it was...
Well, as
it
we
was
know,
so
he was a
brilliant,
brilliant chef.
Yeah.
And no, that was one of, you know, I think we were talking earlier about, you know, to me, what I think are the important things about how learning how to cook.
Yes.
Outside of culinary school. To get
yes.
to that. One of which was dining out.
Yes.
Which I think is incredibly important to see that perspective. And the other is reading.
Yeah.
And not ever having, I would say, a real culinary mentor.
Mm-hmm.
Books were my mentors, and restaurants have been my mentors. So, and that was an important one. I still remember getting it.
Well, that's interesting. But you were saying, so you were starting to talk about this. You said you liked, you know, you don't like the word fishy.
Yeah, and that took us off. Well, I think it's just a perception of people have that maybe don't like fish.
Yeah.
Is that there's a fishy smell.
But
if you really... You know, if you get curious and you know what fresh fish smells like, it doesn't smell like that. It
mm-hmm.
smells oceanic. It
mm-hmm.
smells like seaweed or melon or briny.
Yeah.
And it has a real depth to it. It's,
yes.
It's way beyond. Fishy is the smell of fish that has gone bad or been treated poorly.
Sure. So you, but this all tied into you meeting with Dan.
Yes. Yeah, so we went on this mushroom forage and... came back to my apartment, and I think I made one of my favorite places in the world is Oaxaca, Mexico.
Yeah.
One of the dishes from there that I love is a dish called a mamela, which is a masa-based kind of thick corn tortilla.
Yeah.
Kind of like a taco, but not. You know,
yeah.
It's one of the many thousands of variations of the, you know, of the corn-based snack in Mexico, which are amazing. I think I made some wild mushroom mamelas for dinner, if I can recall. I think we found some boletes and some chanterelles and black trumpets. Drank some German Riesling with that.
Mm.
And I remember Dan saying that he was like, oh, he likes wine too. Which I also think that... You don't hear a lot of chefs talking about that wine these days, I don't think, but...
Maybe not publicly, but I
yeah.
feel like when I go to
publicly.
Dinner with chefs, they're incredibly particular about it.
I think I mean publicly.
Yeah. I find that most chefs I know really know their wine.
Yes.
I don't, actually. You know, it's weird being around food as long as I have. But I'm just not that particular, but most chefs I know are very knowledgeable.
I would agree. But I would also agree, though, that it's not, I think I more meant it's not talked about
yeah.
in an interview, per
yeah,
se.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I do think it's very important, and it's one of those learning building blocks in the kitchen.
Right.
Like reading, like going out to eat, because it's such an interesting, like, diagnosis of taste.
Mm-hmm.
There's this, like, graph of how, like, you can, if you compare the taste of wine with, like, a sauce... You know, it's got an entry point. It's got this point where it rise and expand, and it's either integrated or it's all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to me, it's a super interesting comparison between the two.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm struck, this is kind of an abstract thought, but I'm struck talking to you about some of your like pastimes that you enjoy, mm-hmm. And connecting that to Buddhism, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting to me is these are things that are seemingly things that are done, you know, in solitude. They are things that are seemingly exist in isolation and kind of often private. But they also, where they end is public. Where they end is someone else's receiving of it, right? So you're nodding and smiling as I say this. But, you know, fishing, you talked about the whole process. Well, what is that? That's obviously thinking of food, mm-hmm. and it's going to end up on a plate. That's what you mean by that.
Absolutely.
You know, percussion, that's going to end up going into the ears of a listener, presumably. Writing is usually, unless it's strictly journaling, going to be read by somebody at some point. And obviously cooking. Is usually for other people.
I cook very badly for just myself.
That's interesting. Because do you know why that is?
I don't know. I've been thinking about it recently.
You mean it just comes out clunky or just doesn't have the same like polish on it or
No, I don't, that's not what I mean. I mean that
you don't know how to cook what you want to eat?
I just don't cook for myself.
Yeah.
Like I'll get some dried fruit and a piece of cheese.
Oh, okay.
Or not eat. Or I remember my now wife, when we first started dating, it's like she looked at my fridge and it was like some pita bread, some hummus, some cucumbers and feta, because I was living on like pita sandwiches with cucumbers, hummus and feta for a while.
Do you think this is unusual though? I don't think this is that I mean, I think a lot of cooks are really, it is a very generous thing, craft. I mean, I think it's for a lot of people, it is about pleasing other people. Like, almost like you can't be bothered to do that. You know, like, I have never done a Thanksgiving just for my 4-member family. Like, I even, you know, like at that mm-hmm. level, I won't do that for the four of us.
Well, that brings up an interesting point.
You know,
right?
If I'm going to do that much, like, you know, if I'm going to do that much work, I want to do it for 20 people.
Sure.
And if it's just the four of us, I just assume go to a restaurant. But, you know, so if I scale that down to like a normal day's cooking, it's mm-hmm. It'd be for one person and I don't want to do it. Does that make sense?
No.
It's a little bit of a stoner thought, but does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, but what that made me think of is like, and what I've been thinking about, because it's about like self-generosity. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I mean, we do, you know, our business is very nurturing, but I think it's also in one of the pitfalls and problems in our industry is that people aren't finding their own balance. They're not taking care of themselves, and it's because of, you know, the lack of kind of like self-generosity to be like, okay, I'm at home. I'm going to make myself, like my wife will make herself the most amazing meals. She's a great cook. And I really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm drawn to do the same for her and us. But like if she's out for the evening and I'm home, I'm going to probably spend time doing other things rather than cooking.
And it just becomes like you just need sustenance.
Yeah, I'll just snack.
Yeah, you just need some protein and some hydration and you're good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. It's interesting to me. It's the funny thing is during this pandemic, which I didn't want to talk about, I have become, I have more mojo in the kitchen right now than I've ever had in my life. I'm so
nice.
Into cooking intuitively. I mean, I'm talking intuitively like to the nth, like I start cooking and I don't know where it's headed until it's like being, you know, spooned out onto the plates. Like,
can we talk about
and
that?
I love it.
Intuitive?
Yeah.
Because to me, so I don't use recipes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have recipes. Some things at the restaurants, we have recipes if we repeat them, but I have probably made a different plate of food, many different plates of food daily for the last 20 years. This restaurant, Water Street Cafe, that I started out at Stonington Borough as a chef years ago, had a daily changing blackboard menu. Was there for probably 7 years, almost. I then went to a place called the River Tavern in Chester, Connecticut. Also, very locally sourced, daily changing mm-hmm. menu. Oyster Club, where I now the executive chef, daily changing menu. So I have made probably more dishes than over the last 20 years than different dishes than most people. And I don't repeat myself.
And do you, and you, when you say you don't use recipes, I assume that means you don't write recipes, which I assume means you don't have, you don't archive or record, you don't act as a historian of your own repertoire.
Not at all.
So is stuff gone? There must be a lot of dishes.
Oh, there's it's gone.
If you're doing 365 different menus a year, or however many days of the week you're open, however many, hundreds of dishes, different menus a year, there have got to be things that just you did on the fly and did them once, and they're, you made me, I mean, you can't possibly remember all of them.
Yeah, not even close. I mean,
do you regret that? I would think you'd want to at least have it somewhere, and even just the name of the, even just the menu.
Well, there's menus online if I wanted to go look for Oyster Club. They're
all the way back.
Yeah, I think we've kept most of them.
Do you think you would know what all the dishes are if you thought about it enough?
Yeah.
Close enough.
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
No, I. It's just me. It's how I operate. I mean,
yeah.
I can go in. I don't even think about it ahead of time.
Yeah.
I go in on, you know, morning at 11 o'clock, spend half an hour, write a menu.
Yeah.
I'll walk into the walk-in. I'll see what, you know, we work exclusively with local farmers, fishermen, yeah, foragers. And I'll walk in and see what I have that day.
Yep.
And I'll write a menu.
So how does ordering work? If you don't know what you're going to make... Do you just order the best of the
exactly,
day or the week?
Exactly.
Whatever looks the best, whatever's, or the farmers know you enough to know to bring you X.
We talk about it. In the winter we'll talk about what they're going to grow. I mean, more in the past than we do now. I mean, but we'll add some things. So long as it's nice, I don't care what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so long as...
You'll find something delicious to do.
Yeah, and
with
we
it.
Have really high quality farmers,
yeah,
that are growing organically, super delicious. Like, you know, it goes back to that fish thing. It's like, I'm look at that out there. Fish are going sick out there. I don't know if you can see it right past, see that buoy right there? Straight out past,
yeah,
you can
I
see
do.
Them just jumping.
Yeah.
Sorry, I digress.
No, it's okay. That's why I wanted to interview by the water.
But there is, there's this certain aliveness that you see in fresh food.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to describe. It's hard to, I don't think people necessarily understand it, but it's, I know chefs do some, but it's when you look at food, whether it's a piece of fish or, you know, a vegetable, and it just looks like it's still just, you know, still breathing, still living. And to me, that makes the best food. So if I can find that, and sometimes get very creative with it, sometimes just let it shine on its own,
mm-hmm,
I'm happy.
Mm-hmm. What's the most shine on its own thing you will do, other than an oyster? Like, what's the most, what's the most figs on a plate thing that
My most Alice Waters moment?
That you would do, yeah. Well, Alice Waters, according to David Chang. I don't know if Alice would agree with that. But, yeah. Like, what's the most leave-it-alone thing you've done?
Like, and put on a plate at a restaurant?
Yeah.
The first thing that came to my mind was just asparagus sautéed in good butter with sea salt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
If the asparagus is good.
Yeah.
If it's not... It's not, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, anything else would be a unwanted distraction.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Did it take you a long time to get to that place, or did growing up on a farm pre-wire you for openness to... We had a whole talk today about ego versus egoless cooking, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that to me is egoless cooking. And again, this is, you know, if you're thinking about the pleasure of the person eating it, the best thing you could do for that person is what you just described.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
But did it take you time to come to that, or do you feel like that you...
Oh, yeah.
It did?
Absolutely.
I mean, once you started working in restaurants and going to cooking school, it's hard to leave stuff alone?
Yeah, you always want to... I mean, I think that's every cook's problem almost, is like,
yeah,
you want to just add more. And it may be adding... I think it's for different reasons adding more, though. Sometimes it's adding more because it's fun and creative. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's where a lot of people get caught up, is like the creative process. Like, I'm going to play this flavor off this flavor off this flavor. At least that's for me. Mm-hmm. That's where I get a little bit caught up into that, is that it gets exciting and you get carried away with it and you start making this plate of food.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I've ever done it. To me, that's why.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to like prove that I can make something super fancy and,
right.
And do it like that. It's just because I get carried away with that excitement.
So, you know, you have the Oyster Club. Mm-hmm. I told Jay Strell, who works with you guys, and before I came, and I told you when I got here, I was a little sheepish that I, you know, it is this dirty little secret of mine amongst chefs that I don't eat oysters. You know, they skeeve me a little. I gag on them. I should say I don't eat raw oysters.
Mm-hmm.
Poached, fried, okay, fine. I don't mind the flavor. You got a place called the Oyster Club. Sell me on an oyster. What's the appeal of an oyster that I am missing? What is for you? It's such a celebrated thing that I've never connected with at all. And I've seen it in the eyes of, I've had people come right out, like Mark Franz, who probably is not listening to this, a San Francisco chef, you know, has the water bar with Pat Coletto in San Francisco by the market. You know, I told him I didn't eat oysters once, and he said, well, we can still be friends, I guess.
I'm glad you called yourself out, because I was about to a minute ago.
Were you?
And then I was about to.
Well, I know everyone in your line of work thinks it's like the perfect, you know, like the perfect food in nature is an oyster.
It is very perfect. I mean, it is so like super lovely. And so
go ahead, rhapsodize for me. Sure. What is it I'm missing?
Well, let me talk about this place first, because I think
Please.
That's important in that story. So I believe, and some people may disagree with me, that the East Coast oyster, and specifically the Northeast oyster from Connecticut to Maine, at least in this country, and up into Canada, are the best oysters in the world.
Mm. That's a bold statement, as John Travolta might say.
Yeah. That's just what I believe.
Okay.
I'm not saying it's fact. It's what, you know, there's some connection to me to this place, mm-hmm. and I love them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some incredible people in this area growing oysters. And we have the luxury of getting them straight out of the water every day if we want.
Mm-hmm.
We use a small amount of farmers. We only offer 4 to 5 oysters at a time. Keeps them fresher, keeps them moving.
Mm-hmm.
But what is fascinating about them? They're good for the planet. I think that's good. So you should eat more oysters just for that reason. They clean the water. An oyster processes 50 gallons of water a day per oyster. It's clean to that, which is pretty cool. But I think when we go back to that oceanic thing, I think they really are the purest expression of
the sea.
Of the sea
mm.
that you can find.
Mm-hmm.
And they really take on these like very like particular qualities.
Of the water where they come from.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know how, a lot of people don't know this. I'm always struck that they don't get it. They're the different names of oysters, it's the bodies of water they come from.
How do you mean?
How they're named. When you get an oyster, you know,
like the Nenegrit nectars.
Yeah.
Which I was talking about. Like, yeah they people often know anks, mystics.
Yeah. But that's usually referring to the water they came out
of. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the space.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think the general, I don't know that the general public actually knows that.
Knows that connection.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's a direct kind of connection to that very mm-hmm. thing. And the oyster that I mentioned, Nenegrit nectars, is oyster farmer Matt Behan that we've been working with for a long time.
Right. So they are terroir, not personified, but...
I think they call it merroir. I'm not sure.
Merroir? Yeah. Do they? Do they really?
Yeah, I think they do.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But what's kind of interesting about... I think his is a good example. So he's in Nenegrit Pond in Charleston, Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
And where he's right next to a couple other oyster growers, all using this pretty, you know, with slight tweaks, similar methods of growing.
Mm-hmm.
But his oysters happen to be in a little fresh, right? A little freshwater outflow goes right through those oysters. And you can taste it. You know, the ones to either side might not have quite the same depth as his do, but they have this little... Freshwater creates something interesting in oysters.
Okay.
A couple things. One is it adds like earthiness and sweetness. So if you take another... We're actually looking at Fisher's Island right now. Another one of my favorite oysters are Steve and Sarah Malinowski's Fisher's Island oysters. They've been around for a long time, been in some of the most famous restaurants in New York City. They're fantastic. They're grown right out in the open ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And they are just straight salinity, straight saltwater expression of like what the water is like out there. And they're fantastic. And I think amazing for eating raw. But when you start to go into cooked oysters, I think it behooves the oyster to have that fresh, some of that freshwater earthiness, which gives, when it's cooked, a little bit more depth.
Okay.
So I don't think people think necessarily whether some oysters are better raw or cooked. I definitely think some are better raw, some are better cooked.
I mean, it sounds like to me like what you're describing is that there's a... I don't even know how to say this, but it's like it's got a rounder quality is how some chefs I know would put it. The freshwater, it has it does. There's nothing about it that's going to be, it's going to be dissipated by cooking.
But yeah, there's that, and there's also that same quality when we're comparing like drinking wine and a sauce. I think an oyster has that similar quality, right? It's got a start, it's got maybe a roundness, it's got a saltiness,
yes.
It's got an earthiness, it's got a brininess, that all those complex flavors happen in your mouth that carry the palate of it as you eat it and may continue after. And I think food that's really good does that. It like expands in your mouth. Like, you know, and you could call that umami, you know, you could call that
interesting
is kind of a way to think about that. You know, when you have soy sauce or miso or something like that.
Yes.
And it carries those flavors, makes them bigger. I think, you know, oysters are definitely a big holder of umami.
Interesting. So tell me about your other, first of all, I have to say, for most of the country, this isn't going to mean much, but, you know, I live just north of New York City. I hopped in my car today. I got up here in 2 hours. The properties you guys have here are stunning.
Thank you.
So, you know, I'm here of my own accord. I'm not paid to say this, but it's taken me forever to get myself up here. If you are in the New York area, if you're elsewhere in Connecticut, if you're in Rhode Island, these restaurants are not hard to get to. It's a nice day trip. You're doing really cool stuff here. So I'm just telling people, don't take as long as it took me. Get up here. But why don't you tell me about the other places? Tell me about where we had lunch today, or tell people about where you and I had lunch today.
Sure, absolutely. So we had lunch today at Grass and Bone.
Great name.
Thank you. It's coming on its third birthday, and on Labor Day, we opened Labor Day 3 years ago. It was a culmination of a few things, the reason it kind of happened. One was that my business partner, Dan, went to Italy, and he went to Chianti, and he went and met Dario Cecchini.
Okay.
He was very inspired by the butcher shop there. So he came back talking about butcher shops.
We should say Dario Cecchini is known as, I don't know what qualifies one to be known as like the best butcher in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, really? But anyway, he's the most famous butcher in the world, probably. There's quite a cult of personality and fame around him, and buddies with a lot of very big chefs all over the world, and written about in, I believe, in Bill Buford's book Heat.
Absolutely.
So anyway, for people who don't know, that's who Dario is.
So, and then the other side of that is I have been doing whole animal butchery for years.
You personally?
Me personally.
Okay.
So I think I've tried to break down my first whole steer about 20 years ago.
Wow.
I had no idea what I was doing and butchered it, if you will, to some extent. But since then, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of pigs, cows, goats, whatever.
Now, so, you're a humble guy. How good are you at this point? You must be really good.
I'm pretty good. Like, I'm self-taught. Like, yeah. I think that, you know, I know there's butchers out there better than me, but yeah. I'm careful and I know how to do it.
Uh-huh.
But it is. But I've always wanted to kind of go take a class because I feel like with a little class, like,
you,
I could just get
a lot of stuff would like crystallize and you'd like turbocharge to the next level.
Like a pig, I know really, really well. A steer is, there's a lot there.
Uh-huh.
And I've done way, way more pigs than steers.
Okay.
But since Oyster Club was open and River Tavern before that, I've always had whole animals. So there's always been a pig in the walk-in. There's usually, you know, maybe a few goats or a lamb. So with that, and then with the opening of our restaurant Engine Room, which is our other place, it's our kind of like rowdy burger bar.
And tell people what the setting for that is.
It's also in downtown Mystic. It's in the building was the old Lathrop diesel engine building back in the late 1890s. Hence
it's
the
amazing
name Engine Room.
Yeah,
it's a big old brick building. So kind of a cool story about that. Lathrop used to sell their engines to basically drug runners, rum runners.
Oh yeah.
And then they sold a faster one to the government to catch them. So they capitalized on both sides. Maybe
God.
That's why they're not around anymore.
That's great.
I don't know. So big open space. It's just, the idea was there is American comfort food, a lot of fun. But since day one there, our burger has been a whole dry aged steer with the primals taken out. So the primals in this case that we take out would be the short loin, which holds the tenderloin and the sirloin and the New York strip and then the rib primal.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the whole cow is ground into the burger, all with 2 weeks of dry age.
Wow.
So that's a big process. And to kind of streamline that process was part of the reason to open Grass and Bone. The other part was that is to give our community a place to have access when they're not coming to our restaurants to the great product that we have.
I have to say, I'm not just blowing smoke. You know, I looked at the butcher case. You had to walk off for a couple of minutes when we were after lunch and we were inside Grass and Bone. And I actually took a picture. If I think of it, I'll post it when I post the show. But my God, those are some impressive specimens in that case. I mean, the Bavette and all of it was just, it's pristine, it's huge cuts, it looks very appealing. It looks very appealing.
Thank you so much. I mean, what we are is so about this place. We are so lucky to be here.
You mean this town?
This town.
Yeah.
You know, my business partner and Dan and I say all the time, this town or this region, say that this is one of the, if people knew about it, it would be one of the best food destinations in the country. Because you have, I mean, we're looking at it, I'm looking at this pod of, I think, probably bluefish, 50 yards square out there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this incredible fishery right here, Long Island Sound. There's incredible farms.
Yeah.
And people that really care about it and this deep history. One of our farmers is this, is the Davis Farm. They've been farming here since the early 1600s.
Yeah.
Their product is a flint corn that they got from the Narragansett and Wampanoag Indian that long ago, and they've been growing it continuously since then. We like to say our food has a story.
Yes.
And this region really has a story.
You know what's funny? I hear that term all the time, and sometimes from very good friends of mine, and I'm always like, what is that? Like, what? That's become kind of a buzz phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think, what does that really mean? I get it when you say it, just from the spending 4 hours here, having been to the farm, having seen the butcher counter, having talked to you. I really get it with your guys' stuff. It makes total organic sense to me. Like, I don't need it explained. I don't have that. You know what I mean? Sometimes I do have that question. Like, what do you mean it's telling a story? Or maybe it's telling a story to the chef, but it's not necessarily perceptible to the diner. But I don't think that's the case here. I think it's, like we said before, I think your stuff is created from this very solitary place, but with the purpose of somebody like me coming in and receiving it.
Sure. And I think there's a difference between having a story and telling a story, too, maybe. Because what you said, what I said was having a story, and what you said was telling.
Did you say having?
Having. Interesting. Food has a story.
So that you're agreeing with my point, that sometimes you can't.
Yeah, what do you mean by it's the food is telling a story?
Right.
Because if you don't know the story that the food has.
The diner doesn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes the wait staff can be drafted into that effort, right? Explain it.
Sure.
You know, that can work.
Absolutely.
But I've always believed that if it has a story, to use your phrasing, which I'm sorry I wasn't paying close enough attention, I do think that whether or not the diner gets it, the food will be inherently better and more interesting. There'll be some unseen thread tying a menu together. You know,
absolutely. If
there's that kind of thought on the part of the person, I'm just trying not to use the word create anymore, but on the part of the person composing the menu, it makes a difference whether or not you perceive it as the diner. Which, let's face it, most diners aren't food writers. You know, they don't get to have the luxury of sitting and talking with someone like you. Most people aren't going to inherently decipher it, but they'll enjoy it more.
And you're right. But then when they do, and they do make that connection,
yeah,
and maybe it's because they've come back, because you know, one of the things that we really pride ourselves on besides the food is being welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
And our hospitality is incredibly important.
Yeah.
I think, to me, it took me a long time to realize this, but I think I'll admit that it's even more important than the food.
Right.
And I'm okay with that.
Yes.
You know, I think you can have great food and bad hospitality, and I'll never want to go back, but I can have amazing hospitality and feel welcome and comfortable, and I want to go back every time, even if the food is, you know, just okay.
Well, you know, I think, I can't remember if I've told this on the show before, but one of my favorite moments of my professional career, and I probably shouldn't say who it is, but I went to interview a chef, not for the show, in Northern California, Michelin starred restaurant, someone who's been at it a long time, and I'd never met this person in person before. And I met them in the morning at their restaurant. They didn't serve breakfast there or lunch. So there was nobody else there. And the chef was just kind of looking around their dining room with this very puzzled, almost kind of slightly deflated look on their face. And I said, you know, I just met you, but are you okay? And the chef said, you know, I just had this epiphany. Last night I was here, the dining room was full, and I was looking around, and everyone was so happy. And I thought, you know what? If the seats are comfortable, if the lighting's right, if my staff's being warm to them, if the food's coming out at a good pace, it just has to be okay. And they'll be really happy, and they'll come back. And that's a really big thing for somebody who does what I do to realize after 30 years.
Sure. No, it's totally true.
You know, and no disrespect to all the chefs out there. You guys know I love you, but that is since that has happened, I've heard some version of it from, I can't tell you how many chefs.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
it should not diminish the effort you all put into what you're doing, but it is, I think to me, it's the good part of that light bulb moment is recognizing, you know, this is a narrative that's happening in the press right now, right? That is recognizing that it is a team effort, you know, and that it's not just the kitchen team. It's everybody.
Oh, it's the whole team. It's the most important thing is the people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, first of all, you have to hang out with them every day, which I love.
Yes.
Which is great. Yeah. Even though I'm solitary, I love that energy and connection with people.
Yeah.
I like to see the chef that can be the chef, be the server, operate their restaurant, and create the whole experience by themselves. It's not possible.
Yeah, right.
So I think the point is, well, how can then you take credit for all of it? It's everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, our credit goes to our incredible staff. We couldn't do it without them.
Yes.
I mean, we are lucky to have some of the most incredible people working with us that I've ever met.
Yeah. Do you tend to hold on to people for a long time?
Yes, absolutely. My now wife was our first hire ever.
Oh, wow.
And she still works with us.
Okay.
So 9 years later. But we have people from that first team.
Yes.
And we've had very, very few people, unless, you know, they went away to college or...
Life change. Yeah.
That have left the company.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's what allows us to grow. And, you know, we all understand each other. It's not always easy, but...
It also affords you as... I mean, I don't know. I haven't... You know, I've been a writer for a long time now, but I used to work at a PR firm, and I had a staff of... I had maybe 9 people on my team. There's nothing worse than... Turnover's the worst. I mean, if you have a team you like and you can keep them happy and keep them around and minimize how often you have to break in someone new and recover from the loss of somebody, you know, who was essential, that's great. I mean, it's from a quality of life standpoint, right? It's great to hold on to people.
It's amazing on so many levels.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting where we are. I was actually having a conversation with Corey Chow from Per Se the other day, about this very thing. And you have here, like, it's very rare that I get a chef's application. Somebody that's worked in restaurants in New York City, or Boston or Chicago, in our restaurants, you know, in our kitchens, or in the front of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of our success is just having people. I don't look for that. I look for just a good person, and I think that's so much more important. You know, like that conversation, and once we had a lunch, no offense, chefs, but it's not really that hard to learn how to do if you care.
Yeah.
You know, it's not rocket science. It's cooking.
No. Yeah.
You know, but it's so most people can learn how to do it if they have a good work ethic.
Right.
And, you know, it's just, I've met some of the most amazing people that way. And it's also lack of ego.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you come at it as a beginner, you know, you don't come to the job with, I know this, I know how to do this
right.
A certain way.
Yeah.
My way is the right way.
Yeah.
Which I have seen.
Of course. You know? Oh my gosh. I'm sure. I mean, I would think you'd see it all, maybe not with the applicant pool you're describing, but the people you've described who aren't applying in your kitchens.
Yeah.
For sure. But I have to tell you, as someone who has done some learning in my adult life, whether it's taking a language class or when I went to cooking school, you know, at age 30 to an abbreviated cooking program. I love that feeling of being humbled as a student. I love that feeling of here I am. I don't know something. Teach me, you know, correct me.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you can get past the ego and put yourself in the hands of somebody, like we talked earlier, you talked about you do martial arts, right? And then there's the sensei, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you can put yourself under the tutelage of somebody like that, that's such to me, you talked about food seeming alive.
Mm-hmm.
Like that to me is a very alive time in life, you know, to be in the student role. I think it's a great thing. And the few times I've had the luxury of having the bandwidth and the time and the money to do that as an adult, I've just loved it. And also in a weird way, not that you don't want to try and you don't want to get better, but in a weird way, it does take some of the pressure off of you.
Well, sure. It absolutely does. And what that made me think of, your little conversation there was that this idea, it's actually a Zen idea. It's called beginner's mind.
Mm.
It's this concept of beginner's mind. And it's this idea of approaching everything like a beginner. Like you don't know. So that's, to me, I think that's what that joy is. Like,
yeah.
Because if you actually don't know, you have to approach it that way.
Right.
You know, so it's this marvelous universe of, like, it's endless. Like, you can, you know, it's like they say it's like a child's mind.
Yeah.
You know, that.
Yes.
And that's why children learn so well, because they're not putting any preconceived bias in front of it. And that's one of the things that I tell my cooks all the time, and it's something that I'm a huge prescriber to, is never, the moment you feel like you got it, that you know what you're doing, you might as well just give up. I'm never going to stop learning about food and about all the connections therein. until I can't anymore.
Well, there is. I mean, these are the kitchens you just described as, you know, the people who don't necessarily come to you. But I do think of, when you say this, you know, I remember in the book White Heat, the Marco Pierre White book, you know, there's that line that they all, you know, they wear the blue aprons during the day because they're commis. You know, they never stop learning. And that's a tradition that carried over famously into Thomas Keller's kitchens. You know, even the chef wears a blue apron during the day. And then at night you go into your whites. You know, but the idea is to keep it front of mind that you're always learning, you know, that you haven't reached some finish line. I do think that, and not just in kitchens, I think in life, that's a very important, not just because it's humble and it'll keep you open to things, and but just because it's exciting.
It is.
It's exciting to be in that place. Like, I am dying when this is all over and we can do these kind of things again, because I don't find it online to be as... you know, that it's like the energy of a restaurant is missing when you do Zoom drinks with your friends, you know, but I am dying to take a class. I don't even know what it'll be. I just want to take a class. I hope I'll do that my whole life. I think there's nothing like that feeling of being in a room, having somebody teach you something you know nothing or very little about, and you know, walking out at the end of the class and trading notes with classmates and going home and, you know, being interested in doing more work on your own or practicing something. I just think it's the greatest thing, you know.
It truly is. You know, that, yeah, learning, it's just, it's expansive. It's mind opening.
Yeah.
And the thing that my brain clicked on there was, to me, one of the things I miss most, which is traveling. Because I believe that traveling puts you in that mind frame. And that's why it's so great.
Yes.
Because you get to a new place where you've never experienced it before. You don't know what it's like. You've never met the people. And you can just be open to whatever happens.
Yes. And it gives you new perspective on the place that you left to go on that trip that you cannot get. I think this is one of the reasons people are so, like, my wife is especially miserable right now. She's in publishing and there's all kinds of, you know, conferences. And, you know, normally she'd be going to Frankfurt and Ireland and, you know, in the fall. That's all not happening this year. But you go on those, you know, you get the, we're all like marinating in our, you know, in our daily life right now with no break, most of us.
Sure.
You know? You certainly, I mean, as Americans, sadly, we can't leave the country right now. You know, no one will have us. But, you know, once that, once this is all under control and we can travel, I've heard this from so many people that they're just dying to travel. But I think part of it is the adventure of the travel. And part of it is, you, I always come back, if I'm lucky enough to go to a beach somewhere or get away for like a week or two, I always come back with resolutions about, I don't mean it in the punitive New Year's sense of the word, but just things I want to change about my life because I got away. I got to have an out-of-body experience, you know,
on my
to get perspective on the life that you're usually just too close to. You know, I think that's one of the kind of madnesses of this moment is we're unable to do that, most of us.
No, it's true. I mean, no one likes to be trapped and controlled.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I think it's tough for some people to feel that. But it's also, you know, on the other side of it, not to dig too deep into the pandemic, but I hope it's changed a lot of people's mindsets about what they do have and what they can have at home. Because you're forced to be there.
Yes.
You know? So I think more people are gardening.
Yeah.
I think more people are cooking. They're baking bread. I've heard so many stories of parents that have gotten to spend more time with their loved ones and children.
That's for sure in our house.
You know, yeah. That at times have been hard, but at the same time, like, super joyous and, like, and wonderful. And, you know, it's just allowing everything else to take a break a little while, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, I could talk to you all day, except that I can't. I have to get back. This was great. Thank you very much. I hope we'll do this again.
I hope we will, too.
I think you may see me for a meal here with my family sooner than later.
Wonderful.
Because I'm kind of smitten with the whole scene here and very interested in, I mean, the lunch was great, but I'm very interested in coming back for the full ride one night and checking it out.
Can't wait to have you.
Thanks for your hospitality. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being my first live interview in person in half a year.
I'm honored. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thank you to James Wayman for joining us for our first in-person interview in months. It's been just great getting to know you these last few weeks, James, and I look forward to my next visit to Mystic. Thank you to After School Special for their music. Please check out their album, Double Barrel Single Entendre, on iTunes.
You can follow us on Instagram at Chef Podcast is the handle. If you are so inclined, please drop us a rating and or review on Apple Podcasts. And if able to do it at this difficult time, please do consider supporting this podcast directly at Patreon. That's patreon.com/AndrewTalksToChefs. Thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.